slate. We have a very distinguished and knowledgeable panel, and I'm sure, as the programme says, you would like to ask a lot of questions. But what I'm proposing to do is this, that each member of the panel will give a short presentation up to 5 minutes, but they don't have to take their full 5 minutes if they don't want to. But then, so we'll have those presentations, and then we'll open immediately to the floor for answers and discussion. So I'm going to ask Eric King to give the first presentation. Eric King is the Deputy Director of Privacy International. He's conducted a campaign for export controls on surveillance technology, a successful campaign. But what I know about Eric King is that he has an absolutely unrivaled expertise in understanding the technical nature of what goes on in surveillance. And he is going to, I think, begin by saying something about what takes place in the field of surveillance at the moment.
Thank you, Hugh. I say, while I'm, yes, more technically minded than many lawyers, I'm not a technologist. So I pretend to be a lawyer when I'm with the technologists, and I get to pretend to be a technologist when I'm with the lawyers. It's great, just so long as no one meets. So I wanted to set out very quickly, 5 minutes to go through everything that we've learned from Mr. Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower who has had provided us with front page stories after front page stories over the last 2 years. Is not much time, but I'll do my best. I wanted to begin by saying that most of the organisation I work for, Privacy International's work on this, has been conducted not by a debate, as much as we'd like, not by meetings with our security services, but instead via the courts. The problem that we have in this country at the moment is that it's very, very difficult to have a good debate about these issues, and we've thus far been left essentially to the courts to battle out these sorts of points. And on that, we've taken a number of cases. One on mass surveillance, which we're going to talk about, I'm going to talk about very briefly. The second on intelligence sharing. This is something that we're still kind of, most people still think of as a CIA officer kind of leaving a manila envelope outside Tim's house, but signals intelligence raw sharing is much more pernicious. It's the sharing of huge quantities of raw collected communications every single day, and intelligence sharing in this way it has really been our focus. Another case that we've taken has been on bulk personal data sets. This was a technique or capability avowed by our Intelligence and Security Committee only this year. And finally, my personal favourite, hacking, which is something that, yes, cyber criminals and the like do, but also so do our security and intelligence agencies, and they're rather good at it, and they've been doing it for quite a long time. And again, that has only been avowed publicly this year. The first thing I'd just clarify by saying is that our intelligence agencies do not want to spy on everybody. They don't. I genuinely believe that. What they do, however, want to do is to spy on anybody. And the problem is that this creates some rather serious consequences for all of us, which I'm going to run through. So the first is that in trying to spy on anybody, they've ended up spying on rather a large number of people. In fact, one of the big programs that's been revealed, Tempora, collects 40 billion pieces of communications every single day. This was in 2009. So since then, you'd imagine the figures have increased rather substantially. 40 billion is an awful lot when you realise that there's only about 7 billion of us in the world, and only 2 billion of them are online. And 40 billion pieces of communications are collected every single day. Their estimates, from GCHQ internal documents, their goal was to increase that by a staggering 7,000% over the course of the next 5 years, so roughly where we are today, the figures we're not entirely clear of. And this operation, primarily conducted from Cornwall in Bude, was the world's largest what's called full-take interception site. And so this is the place where the undersea fibre optic cables land in Britain, or one of the places. And it's here that they get spliced and get copied across to to a GCHQ building in Bude, where they're stored, processed, and analysed. And it's there that the metadata about communications are extracted, and that's the who, the fact I've sent an email to who that is, and the subject line, that sort of thing. And that's stored uniformly for 30 days for everyone that gets caught in that net. Doesn't matter who you are, if you're of interest or not, if your communication flows through that point, it is caught and it is stored for that time period. If you're a more interesting character, it's stored for longer, much longer. The next thing that happens is that content is also stored alongside that. Now, that costs more. It's obviously bigger in lots of circumstances. And so they can't afford to keep that for as long as 30 days. They have to keep that for 3. But again, uniformly, all of your communications that happen to flow through that point get caught and are stored for 3 days and subject to further analysis and processing. Now, I'm afraid I'm going to contradict myself again slightly, because while I did say that they're not interested in spying on everybody, again, lots of their programs do end up spying on an awful lot of people. One program that was released just last week was called Karma Police. I would have thought that the person who's in charge... Well, I won't use up my minutes on that. But Karma Police, in their words, was population-scale surveillance. They wanted to collect all events for an entire country, or indeed the world. And its aim, in this instance, was to correlate every user visible to their passive SIGINT collection with every website that you visit. So this is far more than mere collection and being pumped into a database for it to be subsequently searched and analysed, but this is the creation of a profile, the linking together of what you're doing online with a unique profile to you yourself. And this is something that is being done at the moment. This was a story just from last week, and so the debate on that has yet to be had. But rather more kind of serious intrusion in my book. Anyway, I'll stop there talking about just how large-scale the surveillance is. You get the idea. It's a lot. The second point I'd say about why the goal to spy on anybody is so problematic is that in order to do that, you end up creating these systems that essentially keep us all insecure. So there's two things that signals intelligence agencies are in the business of doing. It's intercepting your communications and also hacking your device. And to be able to do that, they need to be able to, well, do that. And so what they do, their goal, they're incentivized, is to ensure that you cannot keep things secure. They've done this in two main ways. One, they've worked with companies to keep things exploitable. So they're ensuring that they can always hack into your phone whenever they want. They have a series of programs, amusingly called the Smurfs, which allow them to do this. If they want to remotely switch on the microphone on your mobile phone, that's called Nosy Smurf. If they want to keep your phone switched on when you've switched it off, that's called Paranoid Smurf. The list goes on. And the issue with this is that the way that they get into your device is the same way that others get into your device. Criminals, particularly more sophisticated ones, and other foreign intelligence agencies. And we are now stockpiling these vulnerabilities for our security agencies to deploy as and when they wish. But in doing so, they're preventing companies from keeping their software and their hardware from as secure as it can be. And that is a really damaging thing at a time when we're seeing cyber attacks in the news every single week. We're not doing a good job at keeping things secure. And at the moment, our intelligence agencies, in my view, have got their incentives and their policies backwards on this. The final area is the people that get caught up as a result of this. To do mass surveillance and to be able to hack into systems, they end up targeting people really incredibly intrusively. If they want to be able to spy on you when you're on a plane, you can now get Wi-Fi when you're on planes. It's crazy. I don't know why they do it. It's their only place of refuge left, but that's gone, isn't it? And so to do that, they hacked a German company called Stella. This is the company that provides the Wi-Fi for planes, and they hacked them, all 50 employees. They read all of their emails. They look at what they're doing. They didn't care about these individuals. They were a means to an end. This is how they describe them in their internal documents. So a vast number of people get caught up as a result of that. So my question now in our, for our next set of speakers that I'd like them to consider in responding, and for our debate that we're going to be having as we get a new surveillance bill in the next couple of weeks, is what of these activities, some of which I've described, will be curtailed? Yes, they'll be put on a more detailed statutory footing. Yes, they'll be more transparent, both of which are laudable and we need. But should our intelligence agencies be doing this sort of thing? I'm sure you all know where I come down on it. And that's what I'd ask some of our new legislation to be focusing on. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you. The next speaker is David Anderson, who, as well as being a distinguished practitioner in the field of EU law, public law, human rights, has more particularly since 2011 has been the UK's independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, and has recently reported in a very comprehensive way a report entitled The Question of Trust, published a lay before Parliament in June of this year.
Thank you very much. Unlike Eric, I'm not an expert in this area. I'm a fresh pair of eyes. I was brought in last July. I reported in May. I've now passed over the baton to a parliamentary committee, which I hope will soon be announced if it hasn't already been. I've been in China and New Zealand until 11 o'clock last night. If anyone would like a copy of my report, it's of course available online, but I have got about 20 copies left, of which I brought six along today for members of the Public Law Project. So they're sitting at the end of the desk, and do help yourself if you would like one. It struck me when I started looking at this field that it was highly polarised. On the one hand, you had people from Eric's camp, and Eric is actually one of the more moderate as well as one of the more knowledgeable of them, who think it is appalling that more and more powers are being accumulated, more and more knowledge being obtained about our daily lives as things move online that previously might simply have been said on the street or in the bedroom and floated up into the air unobserved. And I can entirely understand that. On the other hand, you have the security agency people looking back to what they've described themselves as a golden age of the last 10 or 15 years, looking into what for them seems a more bleak and uncertain future in which end-to-end encryption is becoming the norm. Many people, indeed, intermediaries, beginning to put decryption beyond their own power, so that even if you go to Apple and say, please, what's on this device, they simply can't tell you. Hence, or one reason for the hacking, the computer network exploitation that Eric referred to. And it seems to me that the solution to this, as in the rather trite title of my report, has got to be trust. People have got to be able to trust the government, service providers, telecoms companies, whose cooperation is required by the government, have to be able to trust the government. And in outline, and in my answer to Eric's question is that, in my opinion, most of the existing powers can be justified. I was pretty sceptical about the case for new powers, although I think you're going to find that in the bill that comes out in the next 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 5 weeks, there will indeed be a suggestion that more powers are required. To me, the real key to this was a law that can be understood, first of all. Secondly, a law that was honest. I got more anger than I did on any other subject, on the subject of laws which appeared to say one thing but were used for another purpose. And it seems to me that the law has to do what it says on the tin. And thirdly, question of safeguards. Well, on safeguards, we were asked to talk about the judgments of the IPT. I'm not going to talk in any detail about journalistic sources. Alice has got her own case on that in Strasbourg. Or indeed about legal professional privilege. If we're lucky, we might draw out Hugh as a chairman, who I think had a case on that himself, in which he appeared for Amnesty International in the case of Belhaj. But what I would say is that a number of practices, and what I said in my report, is that a number of practices which were either not known to happen at all, or certainly hadn't been verified, and which many people at least strongly suspected to be unlawful, were not revealed by the committees or courts or commissions of London. They were revealed by Mr. Snowden. I don't mean by that that Mr. Snowden is one of my heroes. He isn't. I think he won't further than was necessary to achieve his purposes, and he did endanger, to some extent, the country's security by doing so. But I think we do owe him that debt. And the consequence has been a deluge of litigation, partly as a consequence of what Snowden revealed, partly also as a consequence of various other things, such as what went on in Libya. And Eric's mentioned a number of the cases. There were many more. Is the IPT, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, an appropriate body to hear these cases? Well, it certainly didn't used to be the best loved or indeed the best known part of the judicial system. But it's chaired and deputy chaired by High Court judges, formerly by a Lord Justice of Appeal. It has other very distinguished members on it. And since it started having public hearings and publishing open judgments, it seems to me that perhaps rather like the FISA Court in the US, its reputation is being improved, particularly since it started finding against the government on some of these big cases. And although one could certainly criticise the IPT, it seems to me there are two great things about it. First, very broad standing rules. So you don't, as you would in most countries, have to show that you probably have been intercepted or anything like that. You can go along and litigate almost irrespective of your standing. And secondly, it's prepared to assume facts in quite a broad-ranging way. Now, you might say that's the least it could do, bearing in mind the breadth of the NCND, neither confirm nor deny, doctrine that the government applies. The answer to that is, well, if you won't confirm or deny it, we'll just assume it and litigate anyway. But I think those are very strong features. For the future, it seems to me we have to make sure that this avalanche of transparency and scrutiny was not just a one-off caused by Mr. Snowden. And I think there are various ways in which that has to be achieved. Just very briefly, three of them. The first is avowal. That means avowal of everything that is currently done. Eric mentioned that hacking has been avowed as something the government does earlier this year. The same is true of bulk personal data sets, a combination of different data sets, and there have been other avowals as well. That avowal process, it seems to be, needs to be complete. First of all, so that Parliament is not made a monkey of. You can't have Parliament debating the details of a new bill without it being aware, at least in outline, of how existing powers are used. And also, of course, so that courts can do their job. It was because certain information was in the public domain or came into the public domain that it was possible for the IPT to hear these cases. And I think that benefited everybody, not least because for the first time it started interpreting this incomprehensible Act of Parliament, Ripper, which had existed for 12 or 14 years without the benefit of any judicial interpretation to speak of. And I think the most important of human rights standards, you have according to law, you have the necessary and you have the proportionate test, as they're usually referred to. It's always seemed to me that it's not very difficult for anybody who wants to do something to persuade themselves that it's proportionate. And it is a difficult test for courts to apply in a very rigorous way, unlike the much more concrete tests they have in the US, where you might need probable cause for something, or you might be allowed to look only two hops away when you're looking at somebody's contacts book. Necessity and proportionality, difficult to pin down. But the absolutely key one, it seems to me, is according to law, because that means the law must be clear, it must be accessible, and it must be foreseeable. And the government needs to avow all these things, not only to be honest with Parliament, but because if it knows that if it doesn't, the IPT will hold, as it has already done in a couple of cases, that what they're doing is unlawful, simply because the law governing it was not accessible or foreseeable. Secondly, supervision. I won't go into the many suggestions in my report, but I basically thought intelligence supervision needed to be massively beefed up. I'm vastly encouraged by my trip to New Zealand, where intelligence supervision has been placed in the hands of a quite remarkable woman called Cheryl Gwynn, who was a member of the Trotskyist Socialist Action Party for many years. She's got a huge file, one assumes, but she's never asked to see it. She then, having got her law degree, did the proletarian thing and went to work in a fish knifing plant for 6 years, ran a successful trade union campaign to allow women to be butchers of frozen fish, and having been a campaigning lawyer for a while and then Solicitor General, she now runs a large organisation. They moved away from the system of one retired High Court judge and a secretary to review the intelligence agencies. She's got 8 or 9 people working for her. Her budget is 1% of that of the intelligence agencies, and so are her numbers. If you replicated that in the UK, we'd be looking at a watchdog with a budget of 25 million and 150 people on the staff. And then thirdly, courts. I suggested some ways in which I thought the IPT could be improved. But at the end of the day, what matters is the culture of people in this room, people who are prepared to sniff out injustice and have a go. I think it's something we've always had in this country, and long may it last. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next speaker is Michael Drury, who is a partner at VCL Burton, which he joined in 2010 from GCHQ, where he was the Director of Legal Affairs. He was there for 14 years, and he admits in his biography of being responsible in part for the drafting of the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act. It says he was involved in all significant legislation concerning RIPA until 2010. So he's in a very strong position to give, can I put it, the other side of the argument.
Yes, so don't throw too many buns, please. It's very interesting listening to Eric, with whom I've debated on many occasions in the past, and also David. If you were to listen to what Eric said, you may believe, and I think these are the words he's used previously in some of his presentations, that the law is a legal wild west as far as interception is concerned. I would actually deny that. I think there are difficulties in this area of law, and I think my role this afternoon is to introduce you some of the subtleties and difficulties which exist. Turning first of all to David's plea that law should be clear and accessible. Clearly the Strasbourg requirement is for accessibility in the law. But if he holds up one of his copies of a report, perhaps sideways, can you do that, David, for me? So this is a leading QC who's had access to NGOs, civil society, the government, intelligence agencies, and the report is a substantial read. I remember the act which predated RIPA, for those of you who are old enough, was called the Interception of Communications Act, IOCA. IOCA was 12 pages long, and that was printed on A5 paper. That was the legislation and the regime which RIPA replaced in October 2000. RIPA is substantially longer than that, seeks to deal with things which in 2000 were really only at their dawn, in particular encryption in Part 3. I've never really understood Part 3, and I don't think I'm alone in failing to do so. And many words have been written about Part 3, which makes it probably no less clear. But certainly I would suggest that RIPA does do what it says on the tin, contrary to what David and Eric would say. I do not for a moment consider that what Eric has described as mass surveillance, those not words I would use, is not available on the face of the statute. Indeed, what's noticeable really about the recent debate and the suggestions that in reality this has all come as a massive surprise to everybody, and that in fact the methodology which has now become apparent, and so it will be said, isn't available on the face of the statute. It quite plainly is available on the face of the statute. I'm not suggesting that in any way the statute is an easy read. It is not. And the reason it isn't an easy read is simply because of the fact that it deals with immensely difficult and subtle issues. But certainly the principle that, as far as interception of external communications are concerned, that an amount of external communications will be selected from a larger intercepted bulk, but selected only subject to the ECHR principles of necessity, proportionality, and the fact that that is known to law and accessible on the face of the statute is, to my way of thinking, there. Indeed, this particular provision was certainly considered by the IPT quite early in its life, and remember the IPT was a creation of RIPA itself, homogenised and previous tribunals, and gave the was given much wider powers in RIPA than had previously been the case. So the IPT, in a case called BIRW, British Irish Rights Watch, dealt with these provisions. Similarly, a challenge to the previous IOCA regime, defective as it was seen in Strasbourg in the first Liberty case, halfway through the previous decade. So again, the suggestion that in some way this is all comes as a massive surprise, isn't it terrible, aren't we upset because we didn't know this was going on, is, I would suggest, an unjustified unjustified criticism. And things are difficult. For those of you who read David's report, and it's a magisterial tome, and I would say essential reading for anybody in this area, and on a personal level, and I certainly don't represent the government or purport to speak to for the government, despite my history, there's very much in it I agree with. But as an example of the difficulties which are occasioned in this area, you'll notice there is a large debate set out in it about the limits of communications data and communications content. The message which indicates I'm emailing my wife and tells me that I've emailed her and where I emailed her from, and the content which says I love you or please put the fish on or whatever it's going to be. So that distinction which is there in Ripper, and the distinction is was based in 2000 on the basis that there was a significant difference in the privacy between the external elements of a communication and the internal elements of a communication, has eroded over the years. There's no question about that. But what's significant to me, and I don't criticise David for this, is that David finds it very difficult on his own part to suggest a legislative scheme which deals with the issues. And that's because the issues are difficult. Where should there be a different regime for externals and internals when you can get so much more information from the externals of communication about where you are and your web browsing history and what sites you like to visit, all are presently communications data rather than the content of communications. So I think the suggestion that in some way it's easy to produce a scheme which is easily legally accessible is wrong. I think that's fundamentally wrong. So there's that point I'd like to make. So there's a lot of work to do in terms of the legislative scheme we're going to see coming down the pike in the next few weeks or so. On a personal level, knowing that the IPT, more recently, by the way, has ruled that the present external interception regime is itself lawful, and that's one of the outcomes of the IPT litigation brought by Privacy International, amongst others, that case is going to be appealed to Strasbourg. There are separate Strasbourg proceedings for those who didn't want to go down the IPT route because they didn't believe it represented a proper tribunal in which to hear these things. I do question in my own mind whether or not it's a sensible thing to legislate in the face of likely Strasbourg judgments in this area and in other challenges being brought by people like Privacy International in relation to computer network exploitation. So my message is, don't be suborned by the easy suggestion that this, is an easy thing to do, that rights can easily be displayed on the face of a statute, and that it's going to be accessible to everybody in a way which is going to last for as long as Ripper has lasted. As testament to the authors of Ripper, I mean, I helped in Ripper, but I certainly wasn't the author of it, I would say it's lasted pretty well for 15 years. And even as David says in his report, it could, in fact, limp on for a bit longer if you wanted it to do so, because effectively it does the job and has introduced oversight. So don't be fooled by the fact it's a simple issue. It really isn't a simple issue. I was going to say something about legal professional privilege. I don't want to take more time on that, though, but I'm more than happy to talk about the LPP issues, which I think for this audience are going to be a key issue in the question and answer session.
The last panel member is Alice Ross, who is a reporter at The Guardian specialising in drones and national security. Prior to that, she worked at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and is the named claimant in one of the ECHR claims which have just been mentioned.
Exactly. I'm not going to talk about the ECHR case in too much detail in front of a legal audience because I risk exposing myself, but essentially what the case is about is asking whether or not our existing legal framework offers sufficient protection for journalists in order to allow us to do our job. Does it allow us the ability to protect our sources? Now, traditionally, journalists' communications, you know, their ability to talk with their sources and to offer them confidentiality is protected by legal frameworks such as the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. under this framework, if the police or other law enforcement bodies want to see our work, they have to come to us and say, they go to a judge and they say, we need to see your notebooks, and we get to argue our case as to why they shouldn't be allowed to, and then the judge rules on that. And there's a tradition whereby journalists should be allowed, or you know, are encouraged to protect their sources at all costs, including going to jail if needs be. Now, what modern surveillance techniques do is they deprive journalists of that ability to protect their sources. If the intelligence services or even the police or even local councils can use existing legal frameworks like RIPA to access to details of who we've been talking to, they don't even need to see the contents of our communication. They can just find out who we've been talking to and who we've been meeting with, and that deprives us of the ability to protect our sources. That means that we can offer our sources anonymity. We can say we won't print your identity in an article, for example. We won't identify in public where this information has come from. But behind the scenes, if our work touches on the police, you know, the intelligence services, then effectively we cannot offer them complete confidentiality. And that is really damaging to our work. We're already, you know, this isn't just some idle sort of fear-mongering. We've already seen RIPA being used on actually quite an industrial scale to access journalist communications. It was revealed last year that during the Plebgate scandal, the police went to access the communications of Tom Newton Dunn, the Sun's political reporter, and the entire Sun's news desk in an effort to out their sources. Subsequent to that, the Press Gazette had a campaign where they revealed that RIPA had been used 600 times to access the communications of journalists. This is the law being bent, essentially, to get around the need to justify why the police wanted to see this data. 19 of those cases, by the way, were for local papers. So you're not looking at serious issues of national security here. You're looking at people trying to out journalistic sources. Why is protecting sources important? In order for sources to be able to communicate with us, actually it's quite similar to legal professional privilege, in order for our sources to be able to communicate with us in confidence and to be able to share with us to the fullest ability, whether they're blowing the whistle, whether they're sharing information relating to national security, we need to be able to offer our sources protection, essentially, in order so that they can communicate with us, in order that stories of serious public interest can get out. I would add that actually, you know, at the moment where there is, in the current circumstances, there's an additional need to protect our sources. Now, in conflicts such as in ISIS, for example, it's easy to see how the same device that you use to communicate with a source could then be used to target and kill them. Now, that could then place a journalist in an absolutely unconscionable position whereby, you know, their communications help to facilitate their sources being killed. In David Anderson's report, he said that trust is very important. And what we've seen over the past year is that trust has repeatedly been broken. The authorities have repeatedly bent the rules in order to get around the requirement and in order to get around the permission that journalists can give. And it's important to note as well that this only came out after the Snowden revelations. All of the information about the ways in which this information was being misused only came out after a national security leak. So what we need in the reframing of RIPA is increased protection and an increased sort of emphasis on our ability to protect our sources.
Thank you very much. Everybody kept to their time within a relative margin of appreciation. So I think we've got about 10 minutes for questions. So should we just see how we go? And if there's a lot of questions, I'll take them in groups. Let's begin by throwing the floor open. Who wants to questions, speeches, if they're very short? Who wants to go first?
Do you want me to stand up and say right?
Yeah, there's a man with a microphone. It's all very nice.
Hi, I'm Joe Vester. I'm from the Public Law Project. I suppose we've talked about journalists, we've mentioned lawyers, they've got rights, they've got a special, maybe there's an argument for them to have a special space about where they can talk totally freely. Are those the only two groups that have that space, or are there others? And I just see what the panel think about that.
Interestingly, if you look at the Intercepting Code of Practice, the Intercepting Code of Practice not only mentions lawyers, not only mentions journalists, it also mentions where you're being given absolution by your priest and that sort of thing. So there are clearly special groups. The difficulty, I suspect, is that where do you end the special group's interests? And again, if you look at some of the submissions which have been put in relation to the amended code, which have been out for consultation, you do see in those submissions the greatest body of work is being done by lawyers and journalists. I agree with you. I think there are other groups. The medical profession is an obvious one, and perhaps one solution maybe to look at some of the sort of principles underlying the Data Protection Act and try to lay them across the future codes, because I think what you will see is, in any legislation which follows David's report, the RUSI report, and the ISC recommendations, you will see the continuation of a legislative structure with a statute and a parliamentary approved code underneath them. Now, you can have debate about whether or not, in reality, legal professional privilege or journalistic privilege or anybody else's privilege is protected based on a statutory basis or in the codes. My own view is it probably doesn't make a lot of difference, but I appreciate I'm rather a Luddite on that. But certainly, I think there needs to be work to lay across other interest groups, particularly in the medical and in the religious areas.
Okay. Well, I recommended that if you are seeking even just communications data, so even just the who was talking to whom, which, as Alice explained, is what actually matters for a journalist, the content is in the newspaper anyway. It's the fact that you got it from this particular person that matters. So what matters is who you were talking to when. It seems to me if you're making an application, whether you're the police or the intelligence agencies or anybody else, for the purpose of determining matters that are privileged or confidential, then that should be a matter for a judge, an independent judge to decide. Not to say there won't be circumstances, exceptional circumstances, in which legal privilege might be overridden, or in which a journalist might be compelled to disclose their sources. But to my mind, they should only be granted by a judge. There's a much broader, as I think your question suggests, category of cases in which you're seeking communications data from a person who is a member of a profession that is known to handle sensitive or confidential information. And the ones I mentioned were doctors, lawyers, journalists, ministers of religion. I also mentioned members of parliament. Of course, there's a case going on at the moment about the so-called Wilson Doctrine and whether that's applicable at all and whether it applies to members of the House of Lords. Politicians and so on, then there you need special procedures in place. The judges who do the authorising in my book would indicate when they would expect those cases to be referred to them. And in any event, any such application would be flagged for the attention of the inspectors, so that the inspectors who look at a section of these applications would look at that one anyway.
There's also a more nebulous category of groups, you know, civil society organisations and so on, where you could say that maybe they don't have the sort of professional background of a medical or a doctor or something. You know, you're not necessarily an accredited member of Amnesty International, for example, but their communications have been found to have been stored incorrectly by the IPT and so on. And you could argue that they play a very important role in the confidentiality of their sources is very important as well. So it's a question of how you sift out who gets that protection.
But you need some flexibility, as Alice is saying, because, you know, who is a journalist? You can't give complete immunity to complete professions. What about bloggers or people who keep a website and occasionally post on it? I mean, in a way, they might be doing the same job in public interest as journalists, but plainly you can't build walls of complete immunity around that.
On your point of judicial authorisation, it wasn't perfectly clear to me whether this involved the intelligence services going to the judge and asking for a warrant in separate communications, or whether it would work as the Police and Criminal Evidence Act currently does, whereby the person whose communications are being intercepted would be able to make sort of representations to the court. And of course, under the current intelligence framework, there isn't any scope to know even whether your communications are being intercepted, for good reason, but party to that is to the ability to make representations, then you may not be getting a full picture.
Yes, but in advance of the application being heard, there are quite different representations to be made. The closest I could get to that with my scheme was to have a standing council, probably more than one of them, to serve the judges who do the authorising. So if they get a difficult one or one that raises human rights issues, they bring in the standing council, who in a sense could be the amicus, or could make the contrary case, or could simply assist with the law.
Although, David, I think the point Alex has made is not the pace. If you're a third-party professional who's got information that the police the police can get either a production order or a warrant. But the standard way of doing it, if a solicitor who's got material, but it's not suggested the solicitor is implicated in wrongdoing, then the solicitor is in a position to argue one way or the other. So you make an ex parte's application. And there's no reason in principle why the same shouldn't apply if they're in relation to interception.
I think that must be right.
I mean, can I just say that? I mean, it seems to me that arguing the contrary, it defeats the entire purpose. Don't forget, and I assume that David's law, as I'll call it that, will be the same before you've actually got to the point of applying for interception, when you've gone through a number of legal loopholes, including whether the information can be obtained by other means, whether or not it's enforcement necessarily. So, I mean, it's fine where you have the other party who is a, in inverted commas, a trustworthy party.
Yes, well, that's how it works under TACE. There's no reason you shouldn't work under any other legislation in the same way. More questions? People are very quiet. It's not... lunch, you know.
Why don't you tell us something about legal professional privilege?
Well, I could certainly do that, but I see there's a question.
I was going to ask more about the future LPP post-Belfast.
Well... let me say something about Belfast and LPP. I mean, the first thing it's very important to note is that the procedures for dealing with LPP material have been signed off by successive commissioners, have been accepted as it was said that they had counsel's advice, and when we put them under some pressure, they just caved in completely and accepted that all the procedures were non-compliant. So, in other words, they were simply not respecting LPP in their procedures properly at all. And that in itself is deeply shocking, because it means that someone had put their mind to it, someone had thought about it, and they got it completely wrong. Now, there are two other things that. To be said. I mean, the first is that in certain circumstances, RIPA certainly does override LPP. That's been so held by the House of Lords. And it's possible it may be that under the new statute, in certain circumstances, it can be provided that LPP is overridden. But in English law, as opposed to the Strasbourg position, LPP is absolute. There are no exceptions. The so-called exceptions are when it actually, if a solicitor is party to knowing impropriety, that's not an exception. There is no LPP. So the position in English law is stronger than the position under Strasbourg. And at the moment, the regime doesn't deal with that at all. And the code that's being consulted on is absolutely, completely inadequate. I mean, it's hard to find words to describe its inadequacy. It simply does not address the issue properly.
To my mind, Belhatch makes a very good example for a general point, which is that it is absolutely essential that as many as possible of these internal procedures are disclosed, because some might often point out defects where none were apparent to those who drafted the thing and were closed. I think anyone who looked at those policies for dealing with LPP would have had great difficulty in thinking that Chinese walls could be adequate. Now, of course, no one's suggesting that anyone should disclose anything that prejudices national security. It's very difficult to see how disclosing these sorts of guidelines or documents would possibly have had any effect on national security. When it came out, the defects became obvious. I think that's a bit of a general principle.
And nobody says, perhaps some very extreme people at one end of the spectrum say, but in general, nobody's arguing that there shouldn't be procedures where, in appropriate circumstances, LPP materials shouldn't be examined. And very often, I mean, with the if you're talking about mass interception, you're going to come out with LPP material. You can't avoid it. But you need a system then where you've got some independent element of saying, you know, the procedure for putting it, for binning it, for taking out the LPP procedure and binning it. So it's not being examined. I mean, under the procedures as they currently stand, basically LPP material was being considered and was actually could be used by people who were close to the cases that the material related to. I mean, which I would have thought anybody would, knowing anything about LPP, would go, eat, stop, don't do it.
Well, I'm not sure that's reflected. That's not reflected in fact in the Belhard judgment, where it's perfectly clear that Mr. Belhard didn't do it, Mr. Al-Sadi won the case, but where the judgment of the tribunal made it perfectly clear, in fact, that there wasn't any prejudice to Mr. Al-Sadi. I don't disagree with his points of principle, I entirely agree with his point, and David's point of principle, but to suggest that it was capable of being used by people in ongoing litigation, I think, is not entirely.
Well, that's what the policy said. I mean, of course, the policies may not have been applied, which is even more worrying. But the policies, the way the policies are written, it was clear that it was where the red lines were drawn. The red lines were drawn in a place which was extraordinarily close to the case. I mean, it was not permitted to use the intercepted LPP material in evidence in the trial. But there was nothing at all to stop people who were investigating the facts for the hearing using it. But that's the way the policies work. More questions? How long have we got? Minus 2 minutes. I'll take one more question.
While we're waiting for that, I'll comment on what Michael said. I mean, he's absolutely right about what he says about the IPT judgment. I think so often disclosure is actually in the interests of the agencies themselves. You know, this being an example, if this policy had been disclosed, properly thought about, put in an acceptable form, then these horrible allegations wouldn't be swishing about because the guidelines would have firmly dismissed them. Another example, going back to where Eric started on bulk collection or mass surveillance, as he prefers to call it, the agencies put themselves in a very difficult position when they didn't really accept that this was going on at all, and they didn't even feel able to put forward some reasons why it was helpful. Particularly if you go before Strasbourg, where there's no procedure for hearing closed evidence, it's very difficult to persuade them to rule in your favour when you're not actually giving them any reasons on which to do so. I managed to draw out of them, it was a painful business, Annex 9, which are actually six examples, some of them rather high-profile examples, although no names are given, of cases in which bulk collection was useful to them. That's, of course, not enough to make the case for it being lawful, but certainly to start.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you to everyone, all the members of the panel.